are listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM LP. I'm Steve Niebel, sitting in for David Gilmore. Today we're talking to Lydia K. Valentine. She's a poet laureate of Tacoma. She's a playwright, director, and dramaturg, editor, and educator. Her proudest accomplishment, though, is being a mom to two creative, intelligent, and caring individuals and activists. In her own writing and the projects to which she contributes through Literary Inc., Lydia seeks to amplify the voices of those who are often stifled, ignored, and marginalized in what has been the accepted narrative of the United States. Lydia's first poetry collection, Brief Black Candles, was published in 2020 by Not a Pipe Publishing. Her writing has also appeared in online and print publications such as the Social Justice and Literary Arts magazine Speak. The upcoming anthology from Blue Cactus Press, We Need a Reckoning, takes its name from one of Lydia's three poems that will be included. She's been a recipient of various awards and recognitions, the most recent being named the 2021 to 2023 City of Tacoma Poet Laureate. Lydia is a faculty member of Northwest Indian College and Seattle Girls School. She's also a highly sought-after sensitivity authenticity reader, developmental editor, and copy editor, and has worked on publications such as the memoir Rough House by Tina Ontiversos and various projects for companies such as Agate Publishing, Forest Avenue Press, McGraw-Hill, and Pearson. You can follow her via Instagram at LYDERARYINK or subscribe to her website, literaryinc.com. And let's welcome Lydia K. Valentine.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thank you for doing this.
Yeah. So I'm going to start with a poem that actually was my first publication outside of the literary magazine of my MFA program, which was through Goddard College. And that publication is called Pitkin Review. But this one was published by Angels Flight Literary West. And it is one of my favorite pieces, and it is my favorite form, which is a pantoum. So here we go. It's called Unnamed. I keep my ghosts close to know who I am. Wrapped in their silken shrouds, I am insulated from your ripe expectations, from the hopeful allure of life. Wrapped in their silken shrouds is where my name hides from the hopeful. Allure of life? No, I can't be spoken into being. Is where my name hides your concern? It doesn't fit in your mouth. No, I can't be spoken into being. I'm the wrong shape, out of context. Your concern? It doesn't fit. In your mouth, the truth is my erasure. It began with their end. I'm the wrong shape, out of context. Daughter will not translate to orphan. The truth is my erasure. It began with their end. You think you can hear, see, touch me? Daughter will not translate to orphan, so I have no meaning in this tongue. You think you can see, hear, touch me. I am insulated from your ripe expectations, so I have no meaning in this tongue. I keep my ghosts close to know who I am. Pantoum. I love a pantoum. It's a form that requires repetition, and Unnamed is in that form. And you take lines 2 and 4 from the preceding stanza, and they are repeated as lines 1 and 3 of the next stanza. Then when you get to the end, if you do it, like if you really adhere to the rules of the form, at the end, lines 1 and 3 of the first stanza, which are the only ones that haven't been repeated, they become the final lines 2 and 4.
I'm not sure exactly what it all means. I'm insulated from your ripe expectations, from the hopeful allure of life. Whose expectations are you insulated from in this poem?
Yeah, that's a great question. This poem was written in 2016, which is really when I began to step into the reality of being a writer and not just do it for myself or think of it as a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
My parents have both passed. My father passed in 2001 and my mom in 2011. And in 2016, my Aunt Michelle, with whom I was very close, she was my mom's younger sister, and we kind of grew up together. She was a teenager when I was born, so she was like an older sister, an aunt, and a second mom at the same time. And when she passed suddenly, she was my last parent figure. The devastation of losing all of them, you know, having all of them gone, was very big for me. They never got to see me. She knew I was going to start the graduate program and start getting my work published, but none of them actually got to see it. And grief is a big part of my first collection, Brief Black Candles. There's personal grief of being, you know, an adult orphan and the loss of my elders. And then there is the national collective grief of the Black diaspora, with all of the loss of Black lives, past and present, and continual. But it is definitely extremely difficult.
Yeah, it is. Let's move along and read another one for us. That was great.
Absolutely. A lot of people ask me to read this poem. It is called Speaking in Tongues. And this piece, people ask me if it was difficult to write. Yes and no, because I write to think through things and to kind of grasp them and exert some control over chaos and times that feel uncontrollable. And this poem came out after the last regime was elected into power. And a lot of people were feeling very unsafe who had felt previously very safe and grounded in this country. Speaking in tongues. When they come in this time, in this place, Nymuller socialists are not first. The strange flotsam jettisoned with guns, garbage bag nooses, metal-lined vans, and more guns are named Amadou and Oscar, Trayvon and Michael, Sandra and Tamir, to hashtag say the name of a few. In this time, in this place, our rage-full voices spill out in protest, but the damn you fashion from concrete blocks of denial, detraction, disbelief, disinterest. Denial, detraction, disbelief, disinterest. Denial, detraction, disbelief, disinterest. Stops the viscous swamp of our agony from reaching you. While you watch from the banks of privilege, we wade in water as thick and ropey as clotted dreams. To live while Black. To marry who we love. To use the bathroom in peace, to keep pipelines out of ancestral lands, to escape from landmines, genocide, and other thieves that steal our children and grandmothers. We wade in the water trying to have the breath to live, the peace to live, the unendangeredness to simply live. Our light bright to midnight skin warps and prunes. The water stirs and pulses with our voices, our steps, and pushes against your concrete impassivity. You look away and begin to consider. Blustery defensiveness stops any progress, but you begin to consider the sandbags you've stacked and keep on hand to righteously protect your position. But now, in this time, in this place. Now the shore deteriorates beneath you. You who had stood so certain, so safe before. Now you reach out your hand, hoping to share in our buoyant resilience. Now you speak out in confusion and fear, beginning to imagine the torment of drowning by degrees in the sputum of our ruptured justice and democracy. You remind, no, scold us, that movements are stronger when we come together, even though the barrier between us was built by your hands, and we are asked, no, admonished, to disregard that dam and the damning consequences of your past silence, even though the raw meat smell of our children's blood clings to both. Forgive and forget slithers smoothly from transgressors' tongues. You present these nonsense syllables as if you're an oracle of the divine, but your purpose, your ploy, is far from holy. I know. Still, I will raise my hand from the chest-deep depths I have come to know. I will reach across the rough concrete of your ignorance and help you stand in your new waterlogged reality, in your pool that barely reaches the knee. I dare you to call yourself a survivor.
That's a really strong statement. It seems to me like that is a response to a part of the Black Lives Matter movement and the reaction to the murder of George Floyd.
Yeah, and this actually came a lot earlier than that. It was, you know, when Black Lives Matter came to national recognition after the verdict of the killer of Trayvon Martin. And so a lot of, you know, like George Floyd's name definitely would be in here if it was written later. And there are so many names. And in the beginning of my book, in the collection, I have a list of names. Before this, I did not really write long poems. I'm very specific about the way poems look on the page, and I tend to be shorter, but this just came out and just kept going and going. And I do feel like it's one of my strongest pieces and one that reflects unflinchingly from what was going on in my mind and in my heart.
I know that you are talking a lot about the response of the white world to the events that were taking place. And of course, we keep seeing that over and over again, that people are in denial about, mm-hmm. about what the life of people of color is in the United States. You know, one of the things that I have been told over and over again is that it's my job as a white person to talk to my fellow white people and to teach them. And I find that to be a real challenge. And so I feel like that's what you're talking to. And I think that is really a nice piece of work.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, definitely. It does speak to that. It's like that old expression, put yourself in someone else's shoes. Like that really is not just acknowledging that somebody else has a different experience, but that the way that they interact with the world and the world interacts with them can be completely different. I don't hesitate to answer people's questions. People have a question like, well, why is this thing that I did wrong or offensive or a microaggression? You know, I'm very often happy to take on the conversation.
I think that microaggression is a good thing to discuss, because I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what that is. It took me a while to really figure it out. I mean, it's a word that doesn't instantly tell you what it means. It's not, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's something like something that I heard my whole life, especially growing up. Oh, you speak so well. Right. And I was brought up speaking this way. My mother spoke this way. My father, you know, but that doesn't mean that African-American vernacular English is not only real, but also that I'm fluent in that as well. But when people say something like that, or, you know, once I had my Johns Hopkins sweatshirt on, that's where I went for undergrad. And someone said, "Oh, wow, Hopkins, do you know somebody who goes there?" And so those imply, "I'm so surprised you speak this well because of who you are." Or, "Wow, you sound so white. Why should standard diction and standard language be only attributed to white people? You know, why can't I be a student at Johns Hopkins?" Or, "You know, you're so pretty for a black girl. Like, I'm pretty for a person, you know?" Or even, you know, when people say things like, "She has such a pretty face for heavier people like me," you know, no, that's a beautiful person, period. It's not just about her face or the fact that her body is different from what is a very negative and erroneous standard. So those are microaggressions, and sometimes people don't see it because it's like, "But I was given a compliment." It's like, yes, and your compliment is grounded in patriarchal, white normative, heteronormative, racist standards, classist, all of that. And the automatic response is very often defensiveness. However, if you were to step on someone's foot and they were like, "Ow," you know, you don't say, "Oh my gosh, well, your foot shouldn't have been there. You know, you saw me walking. I didn't mean to step on your foot. I can't believe that you are going to be hurt by that." You know, and you just say, "Oh, sorry," because you didn't mean to do it, right? And it should be the same way. Someone pointing it out and acknowledging and being truthful about how your impact affected them is not calling to question your intent. You know, intent versus impact, those are two very different things. So,
You know, one thing that I just wanted to say is that you talk about being in a role of educator. I think that one thing about your writing is that one thing to understand is that you're writing from a perspective of who you are, and those are your real feelings that are there. And you're not just preaching to somebody. You're telling somebody what your experience is. And so I don't think that that's. I don't know. I guess that there was the implication that maybe you'd be talking down to somebody or something when you by telling them about your experience. And I don't think that that's accurate. I think you that it's who you are. And so
yeah, thank
you
you.
know.
Thank you for recognizing that. Absolutely.
So let's move along. Let's do let's.
Right, I'll read a newer piece. The We Need a Reckoning that you mentioned. Sorry for not giving you a fully updated bio. That came out, and we just had, and that's through Blue Cactus Press, and we had a reading on February 11th at Seattle Town Hall to celebrate the publication. The event was pushed back a little bit because of COVID. That is out in the world now. So I'm going to read two pieces from that. The first one was written New Year's Eve 2020, so coming toward the end of the last regime's role of power. And it came out almost exactly the way that it is written. And then the second part of that is a newer piece, and that was written on this New Year's Eve 2021, and was one of my poems. They both were a part of Tacoma Light Trail, the exhibit there. And this was written for the second part was written for that specifically. So the first one from New Year's Eve 2020 is in We Need a Reckoning. All right, one, New Year's Eve 2020. They seem to think that when the ball drops and the bells peal, these layers of grime and greed, of gaslight and gunpowder, of grief and grievances will peel away. Consequence can't be trampled up so easily. These 4 years are not the foundation of our country's faults. Blood-washed sediment began to settle on these shores 400 years ago. And even more has piled on and piled on and piled on every new year, every new day since. Truckloads and handfuls of malice, sly, verbal micro-bullets at best, state-sanctioned viral murders at worst, are dumped and thrown like ground glass powder cast into the air. We of all castes breathe this airborne malignance. We of all castes are coated with it, inside and out. Black life here has forever been a bloody business. Our pain, the perverse entertainment of picnic lynchings, phone-filmed lynchings, souvenir postcards, and social media posts. So no, the reign of that unprecedented poser president was not the start, but it and he legitimized and lithified these layers of toxicity. What we need is a reckoning, a wrecking ball, to reduce the white supremacist systems of this republic to dust, to exhume and exalt our milled bones and our milled benevolence. Then maybe the be-all and end-all, the dream that could be America, will be. 2. New Year's Eve, 2021. People ask if I have any happy poems. I want exultation, fairy lights. Each word as loud and bold a celebration as the small black stars of a murmuration, screaming songs despite that meek name, swooping and swirling as they return to a home that last year was inhospitable, but now would be warm and safe. Trust and believe that like the starling, I want light. But what I have for you are hard truths. Inconvenient stars that congregate, disrupt, and claim spaces their own were brought to these shores to be ornamental and useful, not safe. Safety is a promise spoken backward. It's a one-legged chair on a newly waxed floor, a key to a door whose locks have changed, a pledge written by a poor strategist for a promising politician's campaign speech. The ruinous ivy roots of archies, isms, and ists have sneaky ways of snagging, swinging wrecking balls and stalling, if not stopping, if not reversing, any rambling toward any reckoning threatening their intricate systems. But excavation has begun. Happy or not, we fight on.
It's an interesting time we live in. I think of what the right wing is made up of this issue of critical race theory, which is a misnomer, mm-hmm. but the very idea that people would be so enraged that that children would be taught about the lives of people who don't look like them in this country is almost beyond belief.
Especially when you consider that students, kids of the global majority, are taught about people who don't look like them constantly.
You're right. It's the other way. It's done the other way around. Is it? Mm-hmm. Is it? Well, let's teach them about the best people, the white people. That's what they are saying. You know, this the white supremacist movement is way more prevalent than what is generally acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And of course, you were talking about these years of Donald Trump and his promotion of white supremacy in this country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something else I like about these pieces, I mean, I'm the writer, so that sounds kind of weird. But something else I think that people can get out of my writing is definitely my experience and my view of social justice issues and all of that. But also, I'm quite a nerd and I love language sounds. I'm a Shakespeare scholar, and New Year's Eve 2020 has a lot of references to Macbeth and lines that reflect lines from there, like consequence can't be trampled up so easily. And that's just how my mind works. It pulls on so many different things. And the second one has mentioning of a murmuration, you know, starlings. They form those beautiful forms in the sky. And they were, yeah, they were brought to this country to be ornamental. But because they tend to congregate where people are, and they make a lot of noise, and they are the only bird in our country where any individual has the right to kill a starling or to destroy a starling nest. They are not protected by law. And I'm a big animal fact nerd. And so I think that my writing has a lot more to it than people might see on the surface, which is very true of me as a person, and a lot of people of the global majority, for sure.
Right. That's interesting what you said about starlings. I mean, yeah, it's fun in a windstorm to see a flock of starlings be blown around. And one thing that I've said about starlings and crows is that they're very successful birds. And so the more successful a creature is, the less humans are likely to be drawn to them. You know, they see them as a nuisance. It's funny. I mean, humans see every kind of creature as a nuisance. You know, mm-hmm. If it is invading their space, you know,
and
in fact, we have taken up so much space that there's a problem with habitat being left for the creatures that used to live here.
You're absolutely right. You know, this whole idea of my space, people have such an automatic claiming, you know, and anything that tries to find their own way into what is deemed my space automatically becomes the enemy, instead of a recognition that we are all sharing this land that had very different ancestral caretakers in people and in animals, you know, for sure.
Right. Yeah. The genocide against the native peoples here we don't limit our hatred to just animals. Human beings. I've had that same thing about happy. I'm a songwriter, so it's people. Oh, well, why don't you write some happy songs?
Yeah.
I write a big variety of stuff, but I also write things that I always felt like I preferred to say something with my song, as opposed to just having it be a pleasant experience, you know.
Right. And anything that encompasses, that embodies hope, I think be considered a happy poem. And and so you're writing that says something and that wants to plant a seed of thought, even if it irritates people at first. If it can plant a seed of thought, there's hope there, and so that is the ultimate happiness, or can lead to the ultimate happiness.
One can always hope. I don't necessarily take that for granted, I keep on keeping on.
Yeah. Happy or not. Exactly. I have one more that kind of, if that's okay, that relates to the topic that we're talking about.
Sure. You bet.
Yeah. And it's called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And it's after the Wallace Stevens poem, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And I really hope people look that poem up and have it in mind as I read this one. 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, after Wallace Stevens. 1. Among a crowd of jeering vultures, the only still thing was the grace of the black bird. 2. I was of three minds, like a tree where three broken blackbirds swing. 3. The blackbird whirled in the blast's wind. It is a part of the national pantomime. 4. A sister and a brother are one. A sister and a brother and a blackbird are one. 5. I don't know which to prefer, the beauty of our shade or the beauty of our subtlety, the blackbird brewing tea or just sipping. 6. History fills the long window with glass. History fills the long window with glass privilege. The shadow of the blackbird passes it back and forth. Denial etches into the shadow, a hidden rage. 7. Oh, haughty vessels of Babel, why do you cling to lacquered binaries? Do you not see how the blackbirds fly above you, reflecting every hued letter of the rainbow? 8. I know towering ivory dialect and corset tight diction, but I know too that blackbird patois is at the heart of all I know. 9. After the blackbird fell, chalk marked the edges of one more outline. 10. At the sight of blackbirds kneeling in flashing lights, even the mothers of strangers should cry out sharply. 11. He walked from 7-Eleven in a herald's cowl. Bullets, not fear, pierced him when another mistook the purpose of his equipage, slaying blackbirds. 12. The river is moving. A blackbird must be dying. 13. It was sundown all morning. It was raining, and it was going to rain. The blackbird nested in the cedar box. And this poem was in a collection by Not a Pipe Publishing, which is the publisher that put out my book. And that collection is called Shout. It's an anthology. Call Shell.
This is something you could probably read a few times.
Absolutely, yeah, there's a lot in there.
So, a tree where three broken blackbirds swing, that's a reference to lynching?
Mm-hmm. You know, and we think of it as a thing of the past, and unfortunately it is continuing, and I don't just make reference to excessive force and brutality of the police. Like, there have been a number of instances across the country and in the South of Black people being found swinging in trees or hanging after being hung.
Right. Let's read one more and we'll call it a day.
Okay, great. All right. I want to read this one that it was written as a part of the celebration of the 20th anniversary of Tacoma Arts Month. I wasn't born and raised here. I am from, again, Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, but Tacoma is my home that I love. I've been here almost 20 years, and representing Tacoma as its poet laureate is a great honor. I love this place. I love the gritty city of Tacoma. So, a poem for Tacoma creatives. Art in our gritty city of destiny is a fire that never rests. It erupts in a torrent carrying pride and passion, hope and healing. It smolders in coals that refuse to be banked, even when buried in packed ash layers of economic disappointments. Even when drowning in the insistent flood of gentrified waters from the north and from the south. It flickers sly fingers, reaching out to awaken our eyes, our ears, our minds, burning its way through us or to us or both. Art in our gritty city of destiny is a fire that never rests because it does not forget the past. This living blaze sings the song of our mountain, the mother of all waters, our city's most sincere soul, whose true name we carry with pride. It honors ancestral caretakers of this land and the ancestral caretakers of our hearts. It remembers and recognizes those harmed and those herded away. It works to remove rooted blights of injury and injustice. Its smoke whispers our worries and our wishes. It fills our mouths, our throats, our lungs with an air that sustains us, even when suffocating nationwide toxins from rancid politicians and poisonous societal systems cannot be escaped. Even when the waves of this virus continue to crest higher and higher, and there is little civil air, safe air to breathe. Our art, our people are a fire of gritty persistence and power, and we will never rest.
Thank you, Lydia. That was very uplifting and made me feel very good about being a Tacoman.
Yeah, great.
It has been really great to talk to you and to have you read for us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FMLP. My name is Steve Niebel. I'm sitting in for David Gilmore, who is on hiatus. You've been listening to Lydia K. Valentine, Tacoma Poet Laureate for 2021 through 2023. And thanks again, Lydia.
Thank you. Happy Black History Month.